Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. It is a podcast created jointly by yours truly. I'm Mike Quackenbush. I'm joined, as ever, by Clayton Morris, fresh back from a trip around the world. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You went around the world in 712 days.
That's right, in a hot air balloon.
That's amazing.
At one point, I was in a small, bubbled helicopter fending off a shark that was attacking my leg.
That's amazing. Listen, I've often wondered this. I've never really gone up in a hot air balloon, but I think you get up there, that's got to be a lot of work, and then you have to go a number two. Do you think you just hang your butt off the side and drop anchor on the unsuspecting people below?
No, it's actually a term that they use in the hot air balloon. It's called brown bagging it.
I see. Okay.
And they provide them. So you've got – when you're up there, they give you a brown bag.
I bet you there's a lot of hilarious lunch moments that end up with people, and they're like, is that Nutella?
Or a flaming bag that flies down and lands on someone's soccer game. Mm. Where did that come from? That must have come from that hot air balloon above.
No wonder they're no longer popular. I think the hot air balloon heyday has passed.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think, you know, the hot air balloon has seen its time, right? Like it seems to me like an inefficient mode of travel. Mm-hmm. If you have to get somewhere, to me, maybe a scooter, maybe a Segway would be a far more efficient way of travel.
Right. Like, is there like a really remote cliff top that could only be accessed by hot air balloon? You know, like how many places would you ever really need to go in a balloon?
Sure. Haven't you seen the movie Up? Like to get to Paradise Falls, like you clearly need a hot air balloon or a house that can be converted into a hot air balloon.
I have not seen that, although I did very recently see Finding Nemo in 3D.
Ooh, had you seen the original? Or, I mean, without 3D?
I saw it like on an airplane coming back from somewhere, but I'd never realized there were giant chunks of it I had missed. So apparently, like Nemo's father's in it, for example.
He's kind of an integral part. It's surprising you missed that. Ellen DeGeneres is in that. I don't know. Did you catch that the first time around?
As herself, which is crazy because everyone else is like sea life characters. And there's Ellen.
Right. And she does her whole bit where she talks about, hey, did you ever notice what it's like when you're walking down the street and you trip and then you fake trip, like you pretend like you weren't really tripping? She does a whole stand-up routine, like right in the middle of Finding Nemo, which I found really odd. Like, I think it kind of stood out.
Right. She's like in a pantsuit. She's not wearing a lot of makeup. And I just thought, how did you get into this?
Yeah, Ellen? She's making out with Portia de Rossi. I was like, is this really kids? I don't know if kids
right, this isn't so G-rated after all.
But no, thinking about the hot air balloon, someone recently, they have like two big hot air balloon shows every year. They have one out in in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Which I think is the biggest in the country. I think it's a spring one that they do out there.
There's four balloons. It's the biggest one in the country.
You mock, but you'd be surprised. In fact, I think it's actually pretty large. They have hundreds of them. And I don't know if you know this or not, but apparently New Mexico has like the best atmospheric conditions for hot air ballooning, which to me would mean no wind, mm-hmm. right? And I don't know, maybe dry air. So that you can get high in the air balloon without there being a sort of resistance in the atmosphere. I don't know. Maybe mm-hmm. it's higher than sea levels mm-hmm. for some reason, so there's less oxygen to contend with. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that either.
My buddy Mitch, my old show that I used to do, The Daily Buzz, he used to go out and cover that every year in New Mexico and had a blast doing it. But do you know – because I know you're aware of like insurance fraud. Or insurance claims.
I am aware of it.
I know you've perpetrated some insurance fraud in your time, so I'm sure you're aware.
Oh, yeah. But that's how I made my millions clean.
You and Don LaPree from a tiny one-bedroom apartment.
I was thinking about Don LaPree very, very recently. But anyway, go ahead.
No, is it one of those things that you have to disclose on an insurance application?
Like I'm a frequent ballooner.
Right, like that you've been a balloonist. You know how you'd have to disclose if you're a skydiver and or do you smoke? Because to me those mm-hmm. go hand in hand, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you smoke a pack a day, that's the same thing as having once jumped out of an airplane. But if you've jumped out of an airplane one time in a skydiving thing that you did on a vacation, you have to mm-hmm. disclose that because then to the insurance company it shows that you have A recklessness about you.
Right. Now, I don't. I had to lie on mine because, as you know, I chain smoke while skydiving. And I thought, right. No one's going to cover me with this.
You have one of those special windscreens that you slip over the end of the cigarette. So you can smoke even while skydiving.
Hmm. I just felt like, man, they're just never going to take me on, or my rates are going to be obnoxious. I can't afford to let them know this about me.
But it would seem to me that hot air ballooning would be like a very, I don't know.
Lazy?
Right. What's the word I was looking for? But
lazy?
sort of meditative practice, almost. It's almost like having to report that you do Tai Chi on your insurance. Oh, you do Tai Chi? Well, your insurance rates just went up. Mm. Because we can't have you out in a park calmly moving your hands about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't have you calmly flying, lazily flying over some vista somewhere looking beautifully at the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I'm not disagreeing with you at all.
It seems to me these are sort of antiquated notions about what's dangerous. Mm. It's not like you're flying on the Hindenburg.
I think unfortunately probably the disaster had to happen first, and then they were like, you know what? We maybe need to rethink our rates on Zeppelinists.
Right. Anybody who's using a Zeppelin, and besides, have you flown on a Zeppelin recently called the Hindenburg? You mm-hmm. have to disclose yeah. that in your yeah. in your documents.
I don't think I have ever been up in a blimp. I know I've never been up in a hot air balloon. I've never done any of those kinds of things. I've never been on a hang glider, like anything like that. I've never done any of that. You know what's a crazy one to me? And if you don't know this about us, you know, Clayton and I, we grew up across the street from one another. We've known each other for almost 30 years now. And in addition to that, here's some extra backstory to give you some context on this. Clayton knows this, but you, the listeners, may not. My father is a pilot. And I was always mystified seeing, you know, like people would pay to go up in a glider plane, you know, which has no engine or propeller to it.
Right.
That's like that to me is the dumbest idea anyone's ever had. Yeah, we're going to tow you up behind a plane that does have some power to it. Then we're just going to let you go and see what happens. Good luck. That seems like a dreadful idea to me.
Depending on the wind, you know, there may or may not be some problems, but mm-hmm. we may find you broken apart in many right. chunks in a stream bed somewhere in somebody's farm.
Yeah, that to me seems like a needless risk to take. Would be that, and I don't know. You know, I kind of wonder. You think about our lives and where we've ended up after all these years, like that type of. I don't know, thrill-seeking maybe is the word I want to use, has no appeal to me. Like, I have more than enough that I don't need to go and do that. Like, I could see where maybe if you you had some job where you worked from home, you never did anything, you had a really sedentary lifestyle, I guess, that maybe you fantasized about that sort of thing. You know, like, man, I'd really like to go hang gliding one day, or I'd really like to, you know, something like that, one of those sort of thrill-seeking pursuits. I have none of those desires.
Yeah. It's probably like the types that go on vacation, you know, they go to like Ocean City, Maryland or something, and then do the parasailing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's their once a year kind of thing, which I did that once as a kid, and it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with you. I have no desire to do those types of things. In fact, I just got a message from a friend said they have like a parachuting group, I guess like the Golden Knights or something. And
they have a name? What a
yeah, I don't know what they are.
Are they a band?
I don't know if the Golden Knights are an offshoot, sort of like the Blue Angels. Maybe they're like an offshoot of the you know armed services or something. I'm not sure. I don't entirely know. The derivation of the Golden Knights. I think they're apparently phenomenal what they do. You know, this is what they do for a living. They jump on airplanes and they do all sorts of stunts and whatnot. But I was invited to go and do this, or they're interested in having me do that. And I thought, that's fun. But then, like, for the rest of my life, I'd have to, like, put that down on an insurance form.
I see. That's the factor of greatest dissuasion to you is the insurance form bit.
Right. And also that I just don't know that I have the desire to do that. I think it would be terrifying, and I care enough about my family that I don't need to needlessly put that at risk.
Right.
But there are certain things like we were in Germany, you said made the quip about me being around the world. I just got back from Germany. We were there this week.
Germany, Ohio.
Right. Just outside of Akron.
Yeah.
Very important soybean.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of wheat products.
Right. So we were in one of the cities we were in is one of the most gorgeous places on earth called Füssen, which is in the southern tip of the country, which, as you know, you're a frequenter of Austria. And Salzburg and Innsbruck is a sort of a stone's throw over the mountain from Füssen. So you're well aware of the terrain down there, right?
I am, yes.
Anyway, so the appeal of going to Füssen is that there's the Neuschwanstein Castle, which, of course, Sleeping Beauty's castle at Disney World is based on, actually.
Right, and it's pictured in posters and calendars and on every postcard.
Sure.
It's a famous castle.
And it is just breathtaking. It's up on the side of this hill or the side of this mountain. And, you know, to get up, it's like a 2 mile hike up the mountain, or you take it by horseback or you know, a bus or whatever to get up there. So, you know, we had done this tour of the castle and everything. We came down and we were sort of in this beer garden area down below where there's a couple of hotels and different things and just a beautiful vista. And you can like look up the side of the mountain. And above the castle, there were people like hang gliding. We looked up and I saw like three people hang gliding and everyone was pointing up. It just seemed, I couldn't believe it. Like how high up they were. Like, are you out of your mind? Like, I almost wanted to like be like their mother. Like, you guys just get down here right now. Do you know what you're doing up there? I mean, one strong wind gust and they're going to be impaled onto one of the steeples of the castle.
Get out there and help your father with the mountain.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw that 60 Minutes piece maybe last year where they, I mean, it was quite remarkable piece because it was shot with HD cameras, and it was about those guys that do like the squirrel suits. Are you familiar with this?
The squirrel suits?
Yeah, where they jump off the side of a mountain, and I don't know the name of it, and they open their
arms. They look like a flying squirrel.
Right.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And I didn't know that was really called a squirrel suit.
I don't know that that's what it's called, but that's what I call it. And at the end, you know, at the end they pop a parachute, you know, when they're kind of nearing the end. But on their way down, they're just gliding like squirrels with these, like, you know, just under their arms. It's like when Spider-Man, whatever that was, like in the 70s, had he would like
the webbing armpits.
Right, he would spray like webbing under his armpits to I don't know, glide through skyscrapers or something. I don't know what was that.
That was like a – correct me if I'm wrong, but that was like a trademark of when Steve Ditko drew Spider-Man, right? And when they changed from Ditko to Romita, Romita just got rid of that. Am I misremembering that?
I think you're right about that. I remember it was either 60s or 70s, so it was early on. It was either Ditko –
yeah.
Excuse me. Flying has given me a a rough throat here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they also when they – it's interesting. I have to believe, and I'm fairly certain I've read this somewhere, you know, Marvel introduced Spider-Woman in the 1970s.
Sure.
And it was really like a sort of to cover their backside ploy because they were aware of some, you know, whether it was from DC or other competition out there, the potential for somebody else to create and trademark a Spider-Woman character. Not unlike, you know, how Marvel has a character called Wonder Man because DC never had had one as like a counterpoint to Wonder Woman. So Wonder Man exists in Marvel. They created Spider-Woman, I think probably mostly to cover themselves from someone else having that and someone making the mistake of thinking it's related to Spider-Man. And she really prominently had that. Like she would glide. You know, they even ended up making a brief run Spider-Woman cartoon in support of that Jessica Drew Spider-Woman character who came back in the last 10 years. You know, she kind of came back into the Marvel continuity and became very, very popular again after she spent maybe 20 years or so as being like – she just disappeared. They just got rid of her, I think. She was big in the 70s and 80s, and then maybe after Secret Wars, they kind of phased her out. And do you remember for a while there was like a black costumed Spider-Woman?
Yeah, yeah.
Like she matched the new Spider-Man black costume from Secret Wars, and she was even like a bit player, that other Spider-Woman, like in the West Coast Avengers, I kind of remember. And I don't know what they ever did with her. I don't know if they just got rid of her or whatever. But then they brought back the classic Spider-Woman recently. I think that was Brian Michael Bendis who really liked that character and kind of brought her back to the forefront. And
yeah, I think isn't she a lesbian now?
Are you thinking of Batwoman?
Oh, maybe I'm – yeah. Maybe I'm thinking of Batwoman.
Batwoman is a lesbian. When they relaunched that character – I'm not talking about the Golden Age character that, you know, they just basically eradicated from the books in the early 60s. Because, you know, there was a Batwoman and a Batgirl previous to the Batgirl we all think of. I think most people, when you think of Batgirl, you picture the Barbara Gordon Batgirl, the one with the red hair, the one that was on the 60s TV show, you know, the one that's been
– became Oracle. Right.
Right. That's definitely the one most people think of, I would guess. They don't think of that ninja Batgirl, that more recent one that's stupid. I think the most recent one is that Cassandra Cain character, but – even before Barbara Gordon, there was another Batgirl, and she was like – I think she was the daughter of Batwoman, and they just eradicated them from the books. They just wrote them out. It's interesting. I have this old book called the – it's like the Superman Encyclopedia or something like that, and it was written in 1978, and it's incredibly – it's actually written by someone that worked for Encyclopedia Britannica and was doing it as a side project, as a lark, and it turned into a real book. Like, he writes that in that very, like, stilted academic style. Excuse me. And he talks about anytime a character intersects with Superman, they're referenced in that book. And Batwoman has an entry, the original Batwoman, the Golden Age one. And they talk about – this just gives you a sense of like where comic books and maybe where society was at in the 1950s. You remember, of course, the World's Finest comic?
Sure, yeah.
And generally the World's Finest comic was Superman and Batman together and often Robin as well. There's an issue of World's Finest apparently from like maybe the mid-50s where somehow Batwoman gets Superman's powers for one day, which like this already sounds like an obvious – Golden Age comic book concept, right? For 24 hours, Batwoman has Superman's powers. She has 24 hours, and they ask her, what are you going to do with these powers for these 24 hours, right? And you think, maybe if you just thought for like a second, like maybe I could irrigate Africa? Like what could you do if you had those powers? She decides for those 24 hours, she is going to dedicate herself to discovering Batman's true identity. And she doesn't do it. In 24 hours with Superman's powers, she can't figure out who Batman is.
Yeah. Well, because she spent half the day like just trying to find out, you know, just trying to look him up in a phone book.
Right.
Like,
this is a lot of it.
She's like, I'm using my X-ray vision to like look through just every wall in Gotham, and I just can't find him. That's a half a day wasted. Sounds like maybe I'm going to go to his favorite breakfast spot. Does anyone know where Batman eats breakfast? Then I'll follow him home, flying, so he can't see me. You know, it sort of reminds me of like Brewster's Billions, like that Richard Pryor movie where he has like one day to spend $1 billion, and he just like can't do it. I think I could pull that off.
Right. But there were a bunch of caveats in that movie, right? Like he couldn't do certain things to get rid of the money.
Right.
But even so, even as a child, I was like, yeah, I could do that.
Right. Yeah, I'm like, I could figure that out.
You're not trying hard enough, Richard Pryor.
But to me, it was also like, really, within a day, like, that's what you're going to waste your day doing? You know, if I had a day – I remember there was always that game where if you had this superpower, if you had three wishes – remember the three wishes game? And it was always like you could do this, this, and this. I mean, like, who wouldn't pick to have infinite wishes? As one of their wishes.
Right. That's probably the first one.
Right. No, I want infinite wishes. Well, no, you can't do that. Well, no, I can because I've got three wishes. You can't tell me how I can use my wishes. Now I've got infinite wishes. That's how I'd use them.
Yeah, I could maybe stop terrorism, or I could I could figure out who Batman is.
Right.
We team up all the time, and like I'm secretly dating him in my secret identity, and I don't realize it. But
I could make sure that I never burn my mouth on pizza again.
These frivolous things,
or stop terrorism, or stop a nuclear bomb from going off.
Yeah, I don't know. That was always to me one of the most interesting things about that Squadron Supreme concept. Which was talking about, you know, Spider-Woman as a cover-your-backside ploy. In the I don't actually know when they introduced the Squadron Supreme, but Squadron Supreme was like an adjusted version of the Justice League that existed in the Marvel Universe, so that they could play with characters that had roughly those tropes, I guess you might say.
Sure.
And then in the 80s, they made a limited series where they really kind of expanded the Squadron Supreme, and it became really clear that they were meant to be an analogy for the Justice League. Like, there was clearly this guy's supposed to be Green Lantern. Like, clearly this guy's supposed to be Hawkman. There were very obvious analogies to them. And they did some really fascinating stuff with the Squadron Supreme that was far more daring, I think, than what DC was willing to do with the Justice League. You know, the idea of if you did have these characters and they were so supremely powerful, like, why weren't they more proactive? Like,
right.
Why wouldn't they try and do something like irrigate, you know, like the deserts of Africa? Or, like, why wouldn't they try to do something to help the world where it's hurting the most, rather than sitting back and waiting for some supervillain to show up and then going out and shutting him down? And, you know, a lot of that, I think what was done to really modernize that concept, and for the Squadron Supreme limited series, that was all written by Mark Gruenwald.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've probably told the story on a previous edition of The Grizz, I always felt like I had a really personal relationship with Mark Gruenwald, even though Mark Gruenwald probably did not feel that way about me, because maybe, I don't know, I have two or three handwritten things from Mark Gruenwald where I would write something to Marvel Comics and, you know, months and months and months would go by and you would just think, eh, nobody read it. And then something would turn up in the mail. And sure enough, Mark Gruenwald on a couple of occasions actually answered my fan mail. And because of that, I always just – one, that had a lot to do, I think, with why I was so loyal to Marvel. Even though there were times when, like, I really didn't like what was going on in the Marvel books or things like that, I always stayed very, very loyal to Marvel. Even above DC, even at the time when I bought more DC books, I would never give up on the Marvel stuff because – I just felt like they always brought that personal touch.
Right. It was a familial feeling to it. I think we even talked a little bit about that before. Even in the forums pages or even in the feedback pages at the back of the books, was it just had a corporate feeling to it from DC that, as opposed to sort of the more familial, you're a part of this, connection that you got from Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember seeing your Mark Gruenwald letters when they arrived and being hyper jealous of them.
Right. It was amazing to me. And, sometimes two of them I have are just postcards. It was just the back of a Marvel, like a Marvel stationery thing that was a postcard. But that one time when he sent me the one issue of Solo Avengers that was missing from my collection and wrote me a letter about it, I was just blown away by that.
Yeah.
If you grew up in a neighborhood that didn't have a comic book shop, and luckily for Clayton and I, we did. There was more than one comic shop within bicycling distance of our homes. I don't know how you would have gotten your hands on if you missed an issue. You know, once that had, you know, its time on the newsstand had come and you missed it, how would you ever get an issue? Because they used to always say, it was often in the letters pages, like, we do not send out back issues, or we don't stock back issues that you can buy from us, you know, find a local comics retailer.
Right. And you'd have to go to like a comics convention or something like that, you know, where you could rifle through old back issues of things.
Exactly. You know, and
or one of those like by mail services that
like Mile High Comics always sticks out in my mind as one of those, like you'd get their catalog of everything that they had in inventory and you could, you know, you'd fill out like your little wish list and send it off to them, and they'd try and fill in the holes in your collection or whatever.
Yeah.
I remember those DC books. One of the things I really loved about the DC books, because you and I definitely had books that were older than we were. Like, we had books that were like betrothed to us by others.
Sure.
Is I used to love the ads in the DC books, like for the Mego action figures or like these cool, like, Silver Age-y superhero merchandise things that you couldn't get anymore. Because, you know, we had these books that were from like the mid-70s, but we were reading them 10, 12 years later. So, you know, it wasn't like you could still cut that coupon out and order like a glass with, you know, Hawkman on the side of it or whatever.
Right. I love that stuff too. And even go back, look at the 60s stuff, you know, like build your own car or build your own tank.
Yeah.
That was in the back of the books. Yeah, I'm sure there's a whole. There's got to be like a website devoted to just the ads from old comic books.
I'm sure.
Or if there's not, there needs to be. Like somebody needs to create like a website devoted to that. Which perhaps is a perfect place for us to thank our first show sponsor this week, our friends over at Squarespace.com. They have just rolled out the brand new Squarespace and was listed as one of Time Magazine's top 50 websites of the year, just published yesterday. And they are fantastic. If you're not familiar with Squarespace, first of all, use the URL Grizzly. So squarespace.com/grizzly. That gives us a credit. So you can go over there and check them out. And when you're there, just create a free website. There's no obligation. You don't need anything, you know, no credit card to sign up. So if you've run a small business or you have a blog you're thinking about starting, why not just create it for free? No credit card needed. And you can see how easy it is to just drag and drop. You don't need to know how to write any code at all. And if you're thinking that you're going to get thousands of people a day trafficking your website, Squarespace is the perfect place to do it because they'll never go down. They never, you're never going to have like any sort of an issue where, oh, I can't go to your website because there's just too many people there and it's crashed the website. Squarespace optimizes for that. So you never have to worry about that. And Mike, you know, from just like playing around with some of the drag and drop stuff, how easy it is to build a site.
That's right. Especially in this day and age when it is so important that everything you do work well, not just, you know, on a computer, on a giant monitor screen, but be customized or optimized, perhaps is a better term, for mobile devices. That is really, this newest version of Squarespace they rolled out has really taken that into account, because you'll never have to worry about, you know, do I have to resize these things or anything like that. You just drag in photos, graphics, other assets, and Squarespace does all the work for you. It's amazingly easy. You could, in a matter of minutes, create a beautiful-looking website. And that's exactly what we want you to do. We want you to go over there. We want you to go to squarespace.com/grizzly, like our podcast. You see how that ties in. And we want you to use this code, EGGHEAD, E-G-G-H-E-A-D, you know, like the Batman villain portrayed by Vincent Price. EGGHEAD. That's what we want you to use over there. And we want you to get to work.
Yeah, and the best part is we just want you to play with these websites. I mean, just, you know, we just want to see what you guys come up with. Just play around. And if you keep your website, you want to, you know, you're thinking about moving your own blog. Maybe you've got like a Blogger blog, or you've got a Tumblr, or you've got something else you want to move to a more professional looking place like Squarespace. Just go ahead and do that. That's all you need to do is just import it with one-click importing. So it'll pull your old Blogger blog right into Squarespace. You got a WordPress blog you want to move over. It's that simple. And their pricing plans start from $8. And their largest plan is $16, and that's unlimited at $16. So you can do unlimited uploads of photos, everything you can think of, $16 a month. It's incredible. So if you're thinking about starting a business, you need a storefront, you're a photographer, you want to show off your portfolio, anything like that, support our show by just going over there, signing up, and using that coupon code. It'll get you a nice little percentage off, I think 10% off the life of your package. So use the coupon code EGGHEAD. We'd love to see your websites. We'd love to hear your feedback, because I'm seriously, I absolutely love it. And we are going to be, here's an announcement. We haven't made this announcement yet. We are going to be moving, grizzlyproductions.tv over to the new Squarespace. So right now, as you know, we are hosted on Squarespace. But we're going to be moving it to the brand new Squarespace 6. Over the next couple of weeks. So you can actually watch the transition happen. And it's incredibly easy to do. So if you've currently got a Squarespace site, all you need to do is upgrade. Just click the upgrade button and it'll move everything over for you. It's that simple. So I can't wait to see how the new grizzlyproductions.tv website will look as we begin to move it over to the new Squarespace. Anyway, go check them out. Squarespace.com/grizzly. And if you're thinking about creating a website devoted to the ads in the back of comic books, I would love to see that.
Mm-hmm. At Dewey Raymond, I'm very much looking forward to your Screaming Cheetah Wheelies website.
I can't wait to see that too. So play around, have some fun over there, and use them. We love Squarespace. Thanks so much for their support, and thanks to the many hundreds of you who've been checking them out. We really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
So
you didn't start any international incidents when you were abroad, did you?
No. But I had to say, I mean, you know, we took my father over there. It was just like something I've always wanted to do, you know, as a history fan, as a history major. I'm fascinated by World War II history. And the fact that my father was stationed in Germany just after World War II, I was always fascinated about that period of his life. And I thought, you know, it's one of those things maybe you do once in a lifetime. And it's a trip that I did for my parents, but for my dad in particular, because he was stationed there in Nuremberg. And so I wanted to, you know, have him have the opportunity to go back and see where he was once stationed and sort of witness that and, you know, just be a part of that. And so he could, you know, paint a picture for me and just, you know, do what you can. So anyway, we started our trip in Heidelberg, which is just one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen.
Right, just outside Wernersville.
Right.
That's where Stacy Hager used to live in Heidelberg.
Right. No, that's Hamburg.
No, Hamburg's up Route 61. There really is a
I remember Heidelberg, yeah. So it's funny, I think a lot of the places in Pennsylvania, Mike's joking, of course, about some of our childhood romps there in Berks County, but, you know, it's Pennsylvania Dutch country, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of that influence comes from that part of the world.
Yes, indeed.
I think there's probably towns named after towns in Germany on purpose.
Yes. I think you are 100% correct.
I would think so. So it's funny because if you look at the terrain in the southern part of Germany, a lot of it in Bavaria, Germans are very proud of their Bavarian section of the country. And in fact, many of them, you know, from the northern part, think of it as like an entirely different country. We actually met some Germans who said, you know, even Germans vacation in Bavaria. Because it is just otherworldly and gorgeous. And sort of all the architecture that you see, like if you go to like Epcot or something and you see the German section of Epcot, mm-hmm. It looks like it's taken right out of right from Heidelberg. That beautiful sort of open-beamed architecture, you know, with like the potted plants and the basket plants out the windows and sort of the cobblestone streets and all of that. So Heidelberg, beautiful. A castle sits atop the town of Heidelberg, and then we made our way down to Fussen in the southern tip, and then off and over.
That's where Fussball was invented, right? That's from Fussen.
Actually, you might be right about that, to be honest. Mm-hmm. There's – I mean, I think the soccer team down there, Fussen soccer team, they're very proud of their football team down there. Mm-hmm. So maybe Fussball, the bar game – the bar table might have come from there as well. And then on up to Nuremberg, where we got to see, you know, Hitler's parade grounds, which was sort of the Nuremberg, the seat of like the propaganda movement by the SS and the Nazi party was all born out of there. So like even like Triumph of the Will, the famous Leni Riefenstahl film was shot, large portions of it in Nuremberg. So they would have all like the marching grounds, and Hitler would come out and speak to the masses, and it's just, you know, just frighteningly ominous when you're there with the sort of big stone architecture and everything. It's very little that remains of like Nazi architecture anywhere. They've obviously torn most of it down, but this area remains in the big soldiers' stadium. And my dad was stationed a few blocks from there. And so he had thought that maybe the barracks where he stayed were torn down. And we were doing some digging while we were there on a map and found that, no, the SS, Kaserne, as it was called, Kaserne, was still there. And so we hopped in the car and drove over there, and he just about lost it. I mean, it was a pretty tearful moment and a pretty pretty remarkable moment at that. And so he couldn't believe that it was still in perfect condition, like this former SS barracks where they were stationed just after the war. And turns out that the U.S. Army, the reason it was probably still in perfect condition is because the U.S. Army still used it up until 1992. Mm. So they kept it in pristine condition, as you can imagine. So, but it's now some sort of immigration center and part museum, but it was closed on the Sunday we were there, but we got to see the outside of it and everything. So that was pretty cool. And then back. But there are a couple things that I want to get your perspective on this, because apart from just the familial part of the trip, I was just struck at how
dirty.
No, how remarkably clean. Oh. Remarkably clean. Now, bear in mind, we flew back into Newark, New Jersey. Okay. So you know, it's sort of like the Jake Johansson joke about like the blowing garbage down like off the tarmac. But as you're even driving down like Route 95 and you're like, my God, there's more garbage than there is grass on the side of the road as you're driving away. When you're driving down the Autobahn, and I drove almost all of southern Germany, I think maybe 700 miles or something, maybe.
That's like, what, 3 kilometers?
Right. There was not a bag anywhere. I mean, not like an errant cigarette butt, nothing. No dirt. I mean, it was just remarkable. And like road work, I mean, there was not a pothole to be seen anywhere. Now, part of that, of course, is that they charge an arm and a leg for gasoline over there. So a lot of that money goes towards roads projects and universal health care and all that sort of stuff. So, yes, make your, you know, make your political points as you will. But nevertheless, it's a clean country. And we were curious. It's like, when do they do road work over here? Do they do it like in the middle of the night like they do in Manhattan? So as not to impede the flow of traffic. But we would see like, you know, you'd move down a lane or two because they were doing some construction, but there would be no construction. There would just be like sort of pillars and cones letting you know that the lanes had been restricted, but that we didn't see any construction at all. And there was not a pothole to be seen anywhere in the country. Now, this is a country that gets a lot of snow, right? So in this country, when places where you have lots of snow, you get lots of potholes. So I'm just – and it didn't look like they were patching a lot of stuff. You know how they do those patch jobs here?
Sure.
That invariably suck. They rip up like 5 minutes later. It's like, why bother? You know. One thing I will say, though, is how annoying it was that, you know, everything's smaller there, right? So I think because the gas prices are so high, right, they drive smaller cars and try to conserve on gas in that way. But the elevators. Like, if you're building one of the massive airports of the world, which is in Frankfurt, Germany, it's like the third busiest. Build bigger elevators.
Yeah.
Because
they are far more compact about everything. I mean, everything over there is just more compact in size. You know, the public restroom stalls, the size of elevators, the way their automobiles are built, everything is more compact.
I guess you just sort of learn to live a little bit smaller over there, more within your means, I suppose, you know. Because we had so many family members with us. Well, we had the two kids, the two grandparents, and my wife and I. We needed to actually rent like a larger car. I mean, they don't rent SUVs over there. Like, you're not going to find an SUV on the road. It's either you either rent like a Fiat or a Mini Cooper, or you rent like a Eurovan. Which we did. We've rented like a Volkswagen Caddy, like Eurovan. Like, it's almost like the type of van that you'd see like in a Bourne Identity film. Where, like, you know, that there's, like, surveillance.
I'm familiar with those, right.
Like, you know, like a surveillance guy. There's, like, a team of surveillance guys, like Tom Arnold and Arnold Schwarzenegger and True Lies. Like, that's the type of van we had to rent, you know. But it worked remarkably well. But I just was struck by just some of the little things that they, you know, that they don't have. Like, if you order milk, like we ordered milk for our son, it was always served hot. Like, they bring it out hot. And you had to make special, you had to request it cold milk. My son, the one time, had this like frothy milk and he spit it out because we'd forgot to ask for it cold. Just
now,
little things.
One of the things I'm sure you discovered while you were over there, I don't know, this is a Swiss drink, but certainly if you were far south in Germany, you might have seen it. And it is a soft drink. It's called Koo, Q-O-O. Did you see that in convenience stores? It comes in maybe 4 or 5 different flavors.
I did see it. I'm not one for soda much anymore, but I did see it. And there was one I wanted to ask you about, which is I saw this at a bunch of places. In fact, even at the McDonald's. We had breakfast at a McDonald's once or twice while we were there just because we wanted to speed up the process. That's another thing. Like, you'll sit down for a meal. They will not bring you a check until you request it. And they will not bring you a check at all until you request it.
Culturally, it's a different thought process. You know what I mean? That once they seat you, that table is yours until you tell them you want to leave.
Right.
They're never going to rush you from a table. It's not like here in the U.S. where, you know, like at Ruby Tuesdays or whatever, they got to turn these tables every 45 minutes. So get up and go.
Right. Ruby Tuesday. Right. Because someone else needs to eat that broccoli and cheddar cheese soup from the buffet. fast, you know. No, but you're right about that. So, you know, you have like another beer or something like that, and you're halfway through your beer thinking, okay, the check's probably going to arrive soon. But no, like, and if you're in a rush, like, you've got to – it's it's your emergency, not theirs, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
So we opted. So instead of having like a really long breakfast, one morning we were heading up to Neuschwanstein Castle, we just popped over to McDonald's nearby, which are remarkably clean, by the way. And you know, there's quite a bit of pride in their McDonald's over there, and they have the whole. You know, you and I have talked about this before, like the McCafés.
Yes, and you know that was really tested, I think, in Europe way before we saw it here in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think what are they still only minimally rolled out here in the U.S. the McCafés, or are they?
Yes, I actually just saw over the last weekend. I saw McDonald's that was totally redone, so the whole restaurant looked like the McCafé, and I've never seen that before.
My dad remarked, you know, he said it's a shame that the McDonald's back home, like where I used to work on Route 724. And 422, I guess, where they merged down there, they just did like $1 million renovation. And he said, my God, they should have done it like this. And while they did a good job, he said, it's just like remarkably comfortable in here. And he couldn't get over how nice it was in there. The big leather couches and everything. And it was inviting, you know, free Wi-Fi and et cetera. So, but the McCafé portion, they had this beverage, the soft drink that I saw at a number of places. And then when we were at the Bahnhof station in Nuremberg, where my dad back in the day used to get dropped off there in the cab, and he'd always get a bratwurst and bouillon. That was like the thing that the soldiers would get off base. That was like their favorite thing to grab. I saw them there as well, which is this like fizzy drink that has like these little, like, it almost looks like, what's the best way to describe them? Like little balls, like little... like, I don't know, I want to say like larger, almost like small, like slightly smaller than marbles in the drink. And
you're not talking about like a bubble tea, are you?
Yeah, maybe I am. I think that might be what it's called. And it looked like a fizzy drink, though. Is that what it is? I mean, what is that thing? Have you had it?
Well, bubble tea, it's not necessarily European. If that's really what you saw, bubble tea, then it's Asian. What are those things? Not tofu, but they're, I've had it, and it's not particularly good, in my opinion.
I mean, it seemed like it was geared towards kids, so it seemed odd that tofu was in it, but it seemed like it was...
Yeah. No, it's meant to be like a healthy alternative kind of thing, and it, I saw it once, I was like, oh, that looks kind of cool in my head. I was like, yeah, it's kind of a mouthful of yuck, I don't really care. The novelty was quickly gone, but, that's interesting. I thought that was a more recent fad. If it's spreading in popularity,
Yeah,
could be.
Yeah, I don't know what it is exactly, but yeah. So one other thing about that is that I the coffee over there. You know, I've recently given up having like any sort of sugar or cream in my coffee. And my wife remarked to me, she said, I'm impressed that, you know, for like 5 or 6 months now, she's like, I thought it would just be a fad, like where you'd go back to cream and sugar in your coffee. She says, but you've really taken to it. I said, you know, because now that I know how good coffee tastes on its own, like why would I want it mucked up with other stuff in it? Right. But that's not to say I wouldn't get something special, like a, you know, like a Frappuccino or something once in a while. That's different. You know, that's not like a straight up coffee. I think this morning she was out early and she had brought me like a pumpkin spice latte, which I love. but that's different, you know. Or like a cappuccino, you know, that's different, you know, or that's, you know, on purpose. But so no, like no more sort of sugar and cream in my coffee. And I was just struck by, I had forgotten like the European coffee, or at least, you know, in Germany, which I guess has a lot of like Italian influence and has coffee going. Just so you know, it's not like you don't see like a pot of coffee anywhere. If you order a coffee, it's like been like espresso pressed, dripped, right, like espresso pressed coffee, and you get like a small cup of coffee. You don't get like a vat of like a venti that you carry around with you, you know, and you never see anyone carrying a cup of coffee, like outside of a shop. Coffee is to be enjoyed, sat and enjoyed there. at a little coffee place. You know, have your pastry, sit down and enjoy your cup of coffee. And when you're done, you pay and you leave. You don't carry a cup with you. I mean, it's rare that you'll see someone with that, you know. And actually, if they do, they make a point of like on the front of it saying like coffee to go, like in big, you know, big sign. So, you know, like you can get a cup. And even then, they don't even give you a lid. It's like they still kind of half want you to sit down and enjoy it. But
right. Well, that the cafe culture of Europe is very, very different than the absence of culture from the cafes of the United States.
Yeah, to be sure. So while I was away, you were busy at play.
I just slept the whole time you were gone.
Right.
I thought, I am so tired of making podcasts. Mm-hmm. While Clayton is gone, I'm going to sleep.
So you
and
did
I
it.
Did, you know, I just, oh man, I just slept and slept. It was so relaxing.
Didn't right, that's all you did. So you had a dream then. Then you just had a bunch of dreams about the fact that you put on a big wrestling tournament.
Well, a nightmare, I think, might be the way to put it. A nightmare of my own design. But yeah, while you were away, King of Trios took place, and it was probably for the best that that timed out the way that it did, because I was, you know, Clayton and I, we conspire on a number of creative endeavors together, and King of Trios, like maybe I'd say the 3 days leading up to, the 3 days of the tournament itself, and maybe 2 or 3 days thereafter, is probably the busiest chunk of time I have all year. I'm just busy, busy, busy. And so it was almost, in a way, perfect timing, because it's not like you and I coordinated that.
Right.
Like, that just happened to be when you decided that you wanted to make your little National Lampoon European vacation.
Which it was, so. Although I did not see some German girl's breasts, which, as you'll remember from Oktoberfest and European Vacation, was a highlight of that movie.
You know, I have never, with the exception of the Christmas Vacation one, which I've seen a few times, which is, I think, among my wife's very favorite holiday films... I have never sat through one of those National Lampoon movies. How many are there? Three?
No, there's the original European Vacation, Christmas Vacation, and then they made that horrible one in Vegas. So four. But I remember European Vacation when I was younger and loved it. I mean, Eric Idle, he plays sort of like the hapless, friendly Brit who just even getting –
So he plays himself.
Right, but even getting hit by a car repeatedly by Chevy Chase and the family, like, he's got blood shooting out of his arm, and he's like, oh, my fault, I'm so sorry. Like, he's on a bike, and he just gets run over by – and he just keeps getting brutalized and legs broken and blood shooting out, but he just keeps apologizing. It's I haven't seen it in years, but I just do remember it being very funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as I think we've probably discussed, I have an intense aversion to Chevy Chase.
Hmm.
I don't find him funny at all. And so I just can't – since he, to me, seems to be the star of those, like I can't bring myself to watch them.
Hmm.
Like I hate him.
It's interesting. I wonder if – I think my opinion of him is as a result of those films. Like I think I find him funny because he's very funny in those films.
Right.
And therefore, I don't know what else – I don't know what other films I would ever watch of him that would give me a different opinion, right? Like those are the films to me – maybe Fletch.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen Fletch.
See, again, or Caddyshack. I think those films are why I find him funny. Like if there are other films out there that you've seen that are unfunny, mm-hmm. that maybe have colored your perspective of him – I don't know, but to me, like, I mean, there's some crappy films that he's done, you know,
right.
where it's not good at all. But
no, there's just something about his particular brand of humor, like, that does not appeal to me. It must be as a result of the movies he's in, right? Because I've certainly never met Chevy Chase, and I don't think you have either, right? You've never actually met him, have you?
I don't think so. No, I haven't.
Like, there's just something about, like, I don't know if it's the way, like, he mugs for the camera or the faces he makes or whatever. I can't stand him.
He is a dick. Right.
Right. Like, I know we talked about that in the very early days of the Grizz. Like, I think you know this better than I, but within the entertainment industry, he is notorious in that he has no friends.
Right.
And this really came to light, I think. This was not something that was generally well known. But when they roasted him, like, there was no one that actually liked him. No one would stand up and do it, like, in a good-natured kind of way. And he had remarked to one of the comedians backstage about, like, how come they asked some no-name like you to roast me? And the comedian was like, because you have no friends. Like, no one likes you. They had to get us to do it because, you know, no one else would even stand up and attempt to do something, you know, to make you seem like you're not a D-bag. And I remember that I was stunned that Comedy Central showed that, like that bit of the comedian saying that. But it really did seem to be true, and you seem to hear things that kind of echoed that.
I have, and I know that Howard Stern has spoken at length on his show about how unfunny he finds – or not – I guess just – I don't know. Unfunny hack he has become. I don't know. I just in general, he just thinks he's a D-bag. I think he's had Chevy Chase call into his show complaining before because he's like ripped him apart on the air. But yeah, so.
I think that's Howard Stern's shtick, Chevy. I think that's what he does. Right. He antagonizes people and says shocking things. I'm pretty sure that's like his whole career summed up.
Right. It's funny though. He can be remarkably empathetic and reverential to certain people, and then people he thinks are, you know, a-holes and hacks, like Jay Leno. I mean, he's just relentless how much he thinks Jay Leno is a hack. And he also does that to Eddie Murphy and Chevy Chase. So I think these are people that he's just long felt are patently unfunny. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And let me just agree with that.
Right.
Like, those three people, I find them – like, Jay Leno, Eddie Murphy, Chevy Chase, like, I find them all to be wildly unfunny.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think you might be onto something there, Howard Stern. But Chevy Chase aside, we did have this thing called the King of Trios, or as the kids are calling it, King of Trios.
They like to shorten things, you know? They got 140 characters from which to tweet. They don't want to add that the in there.
I had this explained to me, which was maybe one of my favorite moments from a weekend that's really just comprised of bizarre moments. The changing room space was very odd. Usually things aren't very segregated, but because there were a lot of female performers that were with us, there was kind of like a segregation to the dressing room area so that they could have some privacy and everything else. And I ended up having a brief exchange with a former national television star from the WWF and WCW, the Barbarian. You probably remember him because he's called the Barbarian. That's probably why you remember him.
Not hard to get him mixed up.
So a strange bit of trivia here. Another performer that was with us for King of Trios who wrestled in the WWF under the name Haku. He also wrestled in WCW as Meng. Both the Barbarian and Meng are from a very small island called Tonga. And it's unbelievable. I mean, you just think of it. Those two guys, their rise was very, very similar. You know, they both enjoyed roughly the same level of success in two of the biggest wrestling companies. And they're from, I think, the same village on the same island, which is really, really crazy. And these are very scary individuals. You know, there are certain wrestlers. Like, I think the perfect example of this is Johnny Saint. Johnny Saint is a very fit. He's very proper. He's very polite. In the ring, he'll twist you into knots. No two ways about it. But to look at him, you don't think, I'm terrified of that man. Right? Like, I want to give Johnny Saint a hug when I see him. You don't want to hug the Barbarian. And he doesn't want you to hug him either, I'd like to point out. Like, you don't want to hug the Warlord.
Right.
If their names aren't indication enough. But I did have this kind of interesting exchange with the Barbarian. Because it seemed very strange to me. As you can guess, the Barbarian's name is not the Barbarian.
Right, like it's like Craig.
And same with the Warlord, right? It's not like he came out, his mom was like, call this one the Warlord. So I said to him, I didn't want to offend any of them, but, you know, as is the protocol, people with less experience in wrestling go up and introduce themselves to people with more experience. That's a sign of respect to the people who came before you in our industry. And so the time came where I needed to go over to these very intimidating gentlemen and say hello. And I said to him, you know, I always say the same thing, you know, say, hi, my name is Mike and all this. And I said, you know, may I call you Barbarian or do you prefer to be called something else? Because, you know, some people do prefer to be called by their stage name. You know what I mean? So, you know, other people don't. And I want to find that out because these men, if I haven't conveyed this, are scary. And he said to me, he said, everyone just calls me Barb. You know, that's that's because they take barbarian and they just want to shorten it down to like one syllable, Mike. And the fact that he had to explain to me how we got Barb out of barbarian. Now, clearly he thought
that a
this
lot of hits in the head.
Right. Like, I just thought, clearly he feels this needs to be explained to me. So I was like, oh, I said, oh, right. Like, it's short for barbarian. I see. All right. But
and then he got out his bludgeon and right. beat you senseless.
Yeah, he took a club out of his bag.
Right.
And, you know, there were a number of like – it was a very, very crazy, crazy mixture of people all in one place. And that was one of the things that most people were remarking, like – you know, this exact collection of people, of course, it's highly unlikely that they'll ever all be together again. And there are all these really weird interactions, like seeing some of these characters that are legendary in the world of wrestling. Like someone brought like a video game console into the backstage area on one of the days. And they were playing some – it's a very current wrestling game. It might be WWE 12. I don't know what it is. But they had like imported – all the characters that were appearing at King of Trios into the game. So you could, you know, if I wanted to, I could have played as Mike Quackenbush in the game. Like someone made these characters like in the edit mode, the create a wrestler mode, and imported them into this game. So it was really cool to like see some of the legendary guys like playing video games with the current guys or like telling stories. Like I got to kind of sit down after one of the nights and listen to Tatanka, who was one of the guys that was at King of Trios, like, you know, just telling stories about Bret the Hitman Hart or telling a story about Yokozuna or Chief J Strongbow, things like that, which was really, really cool. There were all these just kind of like wonderful little moments like that, not unlike explaining how you get the nickname Barb out of Barbarian, which was just one of like a million moments that was like that. Maybe one of the most... exciting moments, I think, which came quite randomly, was, you know, Tito Santana made an appearance. And Tito Santana is probably known best for, of all things, the flying forearm, right?
Right.
Which Bobby the Brain used to call the flying burrito. Like, in fact, probably people call it the flying burrito more than they call it the flying forearm because he used to say it so many times when he was announcing Tito's matches that everyone just kind of calls it that. And on night one of King of Trios, when Tito Santana hit the flying burrito, the place came unglued. Like, the Palmer Center shook. It was so excited. Like, it was just overjoyed. And there were just these wonderful moments like that all throughout the weekend that sort of I've often thought of – and it's even been described this way in some of the materials that's out there, that King of Trios in many ways is like a love letter to what pro wrestling should be and the kind of feelings that it should stir up within people. And I feel like – you know, you can look at something like King of Trios from a variety of perspectives. Was it a financial success? Was it a critical success? Was it a blah, blah, blah? You can think about all those different things. And I don't know that I want to talk about those things. But I feel like it, as a creative endeavor, it was successful for this reason. When the main event on the third night, right, it was three straight nights of professional wrestling, 24 matches in all, totaling almost – I think 11 hours of wrestling footage, which incidentally has already been released. You can go watch it right now over at smartmarkvideo.com. Buy it, download it, or stream it instantly, whatever you want. It's all there waiting for you. When the main event of night three, the tournament final, was in the ring and it was going down, you know, those of us, I was eliminated on the second night. Everyone who had been eliminated or just was otherwise there, there were just wrestlers that came from everywhere just to watch it. Wrestlers from competing organizations, wrestlers that had no reason to even be in the building. Not only was the wrestling world watching, but, you know, of course, all the fans as well. We were all watching this tournament final go down, and there was such an emotion in the room. There was such a tension to it. And you really knew that it hit because people's eyes were like welling up with tears. And when the Spectral Envoy defeated the team representing Ring of Honor, fans just started hugging each other, like total strangers embracing each other because they were so overjoyed, that they were so overcome with like this raw emotion. There was no other way to express it. And people, you know, people's cheeks that were wet with tears and fans were hugging one another. In that way, I think it really, for a moment, it touched what the pinnacle of our art form can be, in that it's no longer, you know, just about I'm supposed to cheer for this guy or boo that guy or that kind of thing, but that some intense communal emotion. And it wasn't just outside. It wasn't like, you know, on the one side of the guardrail where it was just the fans experience it. But the wrestlers who were watching this happen were overcome with that same emotion. And for a moment, we all felt it. Everyone that, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of fans that were packed into the Palmer Center and the staff and the other wrestlers, including the men in the ring at that exact moment, were just united by this intense emotional outpouring. And that's a really unique thing. And I feel like maybe if you go back and you listen to the Grizz that we recorded right after last year's King of Trios, which was in April of last year, you know, so about 19 months have passed since the King of Trios took place. What was most amazing was I think a lot of us came into the weekend feeling like we will never capture that level of emotion again. And while it was a little different in terms of its scale, in terms of its undeniability, that emotion was there. It was a little different, but it was there at that level again. And it just left – you just saw people leaving with this immense positivity, the performers as well as, you know, the fans that were there. And it was, in that way, an unequivocal success. And it was really unique. It was really, really something very, very unique. My favorite review of the weekend, really, people were saying that this was not just about professional wrestling. This was a life experience that you'll never forget.
It almost sounds like like the wall being torn down between East and West Berlin. Mm. Like the hugging and the and it's hard for me to imagine having, you know, I didn't get to stay for some of the matches during King of Trios last time, but it seemed like there was quite a bit of camaraderie there among the fans, and it's hard for me to imagine because I think I've not had that level of connectivity, I guess, at a wrestling event, maybe because of the ones that I've gone to over the years. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find, I would think. So that's probably
it is rare,
pretty darn,
you know,
remarkable.
It's rare. I think you and I we've often remarked about this in our youth, how much we were invested as fans in the tag team of the 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty, this sort of underdog tag team that never seemed to get their due. And not that they were together for a very long period of time. They were kind of slapped together, I think. And how incredible it felt when these guys that you rooted for and you wanted to see them succeed, they did. They very briefly, for a period of about a week, they were the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. And the way that made you feel for us as supporters of those guys, because they were definitely not the guys that were pushed the hardest, you know, they were never portrayed as being like the top act, but that they prevailed, that they triumphed, and that really created a unique emotion within us as a fan. And to be able to capture that or to create that for modern fans is really unique. And what makes it really unique is that exact tag team happened to appear at King of Trios this past weekend. The 1-2-3 Kid and Marty Jannetty reunited. And I don't know if they've tagged together since they were World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions in January of 94 or not. But
right.
It was really, really unique. There was a wonderful blend of not just nostalgia, you know, because certainly there are events that coast on nothing more than nostalgia, but that sort of served it up with a modern flair for a current audience and did it in a way that was in no way condescending or maybe patronizing is what I want to say.
Well, I want to hear more about that match in a moment because I know there's some other matches maybe you want to talk about too. You can bring us some highlights and some moments from it. So before we do that and wrap things up here, why don't you tell us about our good friends over at Cobra, Cobra Electronics, the makers of a whole host of devices that just make your life better, easier, more manageable.
That's true. You know, Cobra is no longer a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world. using, you know, weapons that they buy from Destro. In fact, I don't even think this is the same company, Clayton.
No, I think you're completely different. I know you're thinking of Cobra from G.I. Joe, and this is completely different.
Right. Now, the people that from Cobra Electronics that I know, they do wear navy blue uniforms with a Cobra insignia and like bandanas over their mouths.
Right. They have a silver-faced leader.
Right. Now, other than that, I don't think there's any exact connection to the other Cobra that we're thinking of. But those guys, they're not helpful at all. Whereas Cobra Electronics, they're really helpful.
That's right.
They're quite helpful. Among their ingenious inventions is the Cobra Tag System. This is a two-way locator. It's a great gift idea as the holidays draw near. If you know somebody that, they're always the person that misplaces their briefcase or the person that misplaces their keys or whatever it might be, you can get the Cobra Tag two-way locator system that pairs with your smartphone, and then you attach this Cobra Tag to any item whatever that thing is that you cannot manage to keep track of, whether it's your purse. Really, you could put it on your dog's collar if you wanted to. I don't know that they recommend that, but you could definitely do it.
Why not, though?
Right, yeah, you certainly could. And in the event that this thing was ever to lose itself or misplace itself, you could locate it using your smartphone or vice versa. If you lost your smartphone but you had your dog, you could ring your phone from the dog. In the event that you're outside the range of the Cobra Tag system and you have that smartphone that you've paired it with, it'll just draw you a map to where you lost it so you can go and find it. It's ingenious, this thing. And you can save, especially like on the Cobra Tag. I'm not sure if this is still going on. You want to go look right now. Go to Cobra.com and look on their left-hand navigation in the specials section for a while. And it might still be going on a little bit longer. They were offering buy one, get one free on the Cobra Tag. So you can get one for yourself, wrap that other one up, and give it away as a Christmas gift to somebody that you know. And then your Christmas shopping's done in September. Isn't that amazing? They also do a tremendous professional-grade GPS stuff. Among their great related products is the Cobra iRadar system, which I use every single time I am road tripping. It makes me a safer and more alert driver. And since I started using the Cobra iRadar, I haven't gotten a single ticket. And I used to be the get-a-ticket-every-year kind of guy. So go and check it out. A world of incredible electronic innovations await you over at our friends and foes of G.I. Joe, Cobra Electronics. They're on the web at Cobra.com. They make this program and others like it, including my podcast, Daddy on Board, possible to deliver to you free week in and week out. So show them some love, because we can't make this without them, and they need you.
We thank them for their support. Again, they cover the bandwidth here and the hosting and all that, so we really appreciate it. So back to King of Trois. You had a couple of key matches. Now, explain to me how this works. I mean, sort of highlighted matches each of the three nights, or – I mean, how does all that unfold? And you had – so Marty Jannetty, the 1-2-3 Kid, were there. Now, what night did that happen?
That happened on night three. On night three, we have every year a tag team gauntlet match where a team starts and the winner stays on. So if they keep beating people, they stay on until they get defeated, until 10 teams have come through the gauntlet. And Marty Jannetty and the 1-2-3 Kid were a surprise, a very pleasant surprise, as was the appearance of Demolition Axe and Smash. It was kind of apropos in a way. You know, this year's King of Trios was sort of framed around the theme of our favorite wrestling video game, WWF WrestleFest, which was in arcades in the very early 90s. And so it only seemed apropos that there be – that whatever elements of nostalgia were presented seemed to mirror that era of the World Wrestling Federation when WrestleFest was in arcades, which it was in the early – really until they introduced – there wasn't another WWF arcade game, I think, until 96. So really like for quite a few years there, that was the World Wrestling Federation video game that you came across in arcades. And, I mean, just from the likes of having a Tito Santana or, you know, Demolition were actually in that game. They were in the WrestleFest game. It's sad in a way to look back at that game and see how many of the featured stars in that have passed away. You know, Mr. Perfect, Kirk Hennig, who's deceased, the Big Boss Man, Demolition Crush,
right.
Road Warrior Hawk. A lot of those guys have passed away, sadly. You know, the tournament starts – night one is all tournament matches, 8 tournament matches. But then as teams are eliminated, a lot of the wrestlers come back in non-tournament matches throughout the weekend. Now, some of them, you know, they choose to go home. If they get eliminated from the tournament, they go home. But many others stay on, and it really led to some of the highlights later on throughout the weekend. Some of the non-tournament matches were really outstanding this year. There was an incredible tag team match which featured Manami Toyota and Kaori Yonayama against Tsubasa Kuragaki and Commando Bolshoi, four Japanese women who just blew the roof off the Palmer Center on night three with a breathtaking display. And it all just built and built and built really, really neatly to a wonderful crescendo in the finals. And as I said, all of it's available right now. You can have it as an MP4 to put on your mobile device. You could stream it starting almost instantaneously. It starts playing on your computer. Or you can own the physical media if you like. There was a beautiful cover done by I can't actually think of the artist's name. His last name is Kirby, but it's not the, you know, obviously it's not anyone related to Jack Kirby. Is Jack Kirby died some time ago, but a beautiful triptych cover done across the three nights of King of Trios. It is our WrestleMania, and it is most certainly the one weekend of the year when the entire wrestling world pays attention to what the little wrestling company that could does, and we did it in grand fashion across those three nights, and it was just it was tremendous. One, of course, it's a tremendous amount of work, but it also proved to be tremendous fun, and it's always fun to be able to, you know, like that run-in with the Barbarian or things like that, to shed a little light on some of those bizarre moments that happen away from the fans' view, because sometimes a lot of the magic of that is, you know, not what happens out on stage. Luckily, this year for us, so much of the magic did happen on stage, and the fans got to really experience it as it went down. It was just tremendous fun for everybody for that whole weekend, and left immense positivity with everyone that it touched.
Well, now get over it and start planning for next year.
Mm-hmm, right.
Let that haze wear off and start getting out the pen and pencil.
That's right. And the Pez dispenser.
Start mapping it out
that's
for
usually,
next year.
That's usually where we do it. We do it with Pez dispensers.
Like. Yeah. So I've decided this week, well, I have about 7 days left until I'm going to be doing some stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm. That's not a lot of time to get ready, Clayton.
Yeah. I'm absolutely dreading it. You know, I spent the better part of the flight on my way back sort of mapping out some things to say. Mm-hmm. But God, boy, it's a totally different feeling now back than when I was writing like stand-up when I was 16 years old with like no world experiences to speak of. It's like, who's this 16-year-old punk on stage telling me about this and that and family life?
Right. Now, to be fair, all of your routine was about Velcro wallets back then.
Right. Which was all my experience at the time.
Right.
Because I had a best friend who still to this day uses a Velcro wallet. So that's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I knew in my world. So I'll be I'm nervous. I don't know how long. Like, my wife's like, you know, if you want to try out some of the stuff on me, I'm like, no. Like, you know, what what I'm good at, I'll just, you know, sort of practice in front of a mirror, or I'll sort of just practice in my room alone and try to map it out. Because, you know, as you write it, like, I'm picturing how I'll deliver it, which is completely different than the way I'm writing it.
Mm-hmm.
The timing, the beats on different things, like the way that this is going to come out on stage, I've got to nail it, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no room for error. So while I'm only up there for 5 minutes, I do want to nail it, and I can't do it ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. Did you, when you were doing some stand up for your improv stuff, did you end up like doing it ahead of time?
No, I would literally. I know. I mean, this says something about my general workflow. I would give it zero thought until I was driving to the theater, and I would practice it in my rearview mirror to myself.
That's like Clint Eastwood's speech the other night. At the RNC, he admitted that he didn't know what he was going to say until like a minute before going on stage, which I think is evidence of the speech itself. But
no, I just felt like it was truer to the spirit of improv. You know, like if I was working off a bunch of index cards, like I didn't, you know. So every show, you know, I would open with a monologue, and I'd just do it on the drive to the theater. I'd run it through once in my head, and I would either think, yes, I'm keeping this, or no, I need to come up with something else when I'm out there, and that's it. I gave it no more thought than that.
Jeez. Yeah, I just don't know that I could do that.
I didn't say any of them were good, Clayton.
Right.
I just
would be petrified because I'd get up there, and if I was going to riff on something, I don't know. Maybe I think I could handle some of that, and I think some of that in the room, you know, kind of happens naturally as you're kind of going along. Something kind of interrupts you, and you just kind of go off on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's always the mistake, though. I found that if you start like riffing or going off on a tangent because you just it just kind of comes to you and you start winging it, then you start losing yourself. And mm-hmm. you start going off on this tangent that can really, unless you're like a professional comedian, can really pull you off the deep end.
Well, now something you may or may not know about Clayton is that Clayton did for a while play saxophone. And I think probably what would be best for you if you keep this in your mind as it relates to riffing and things like that, something that you can relate to, is if you're on stage and it starts to go badly, just play your saxophone.
There was a guy – there was one guy who opened for me one time when I was doing stand-up. And you know, you always want to try to go on after someone who's done a good job. Right, you don't want the room to be down. You know, it's like Seinfeld talking about going on after Banya, because he would just destroy the room. Right,
right.
So he's like, I can't go on after Banya. Do you hear? He was killing. He died out there, and then it's always harder for you, you know, to go on afterwards. So this guy was just bombing, and I had to follow him, and he was a portly guy. So his salvation, and I don't even know that it really wasn't a salvation, but it was his attempt at a salvation for a joke, was to get up there at the end when he just kept bombing with every joke he was saying. Finally, he just turns to the audience and he says, you want to see my nipples?
Mm.
And that got like just a moderate laugh. Mm. And that's how we ended it. He's like, all right, good night, everyone. I was like, oh, great. Thank God you finished on a high note. Mm.
Yeah, do you think like when you're bombing that bad and you get a moderate laugh, like you come off and you're like, yeah, I nailed it. Because that's the last thing.
Right, that's the last thing you'll remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a while to warm him up, but I really had him there at the end with the
high
nipple
five.
Thing.
Go get him, Clayton. Thanks, man. Thanks. Thanks for really killing it. I appreciate it.
Now, if people want to come out and see you, Clayton, where could they do this?
Yeah. I'll be at the laugh bone. In Decatur, Illinois. Uh-huh. No, I think it's...
Is like, that near Germany, Ohio?
Yeah, just outside of Heidelberg. No, I don't want anyone to come see me.
I want to play to no crowd. Right. This is a charity gig, right? Help me raise no money.
Right, that's the thing. If it's just the organizer, I'll be happy. Yeah, I think... I don't know. They sent me the thing to send out to people. I don't know that I want to do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like next Thursday or something, so I'm already terrified.
Mm.
Terrified. But anyway. And it was funny, they like printed up a whole thing in the New York Post about it. So it's got like my face in the New York Post with like five other people that are competing. And I'm like, oh, great. Now that it's in there, I can't back out now.
Mm. It's in the Post.
It's in the Post. Once it's the word, you know? Mm. So anyway.
Well, expect to see a lot of tweets on the Grizzly Bear Cafe Twitter stream about where you can get tickets to see Clayton.
Yeah.
Who'll be telling some jokes and playing saxophone, about 4 minutes of saxophone, I think. for charity. He'll be doing this all for charity.
Be doing all for love, like Brian Adams. Well, that's going to do it for the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Be sure to check out our show sponsors. Go over to squarespace.com/grizzly and play around. Sign up. Try out a free website. No purchase required. And if you want to, of course, build a website there permanently, please use the coupon code EGGHEAD to get you some good discounts over the life of your plan, as well as our friends over at Cobra Electronics. Go check them out and everything those fine folks are doing. Any final words? Any final regrets?
No, I think that about covers it for the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Other than all this, of course, you know, Clayton's on Fox and Friends. You can catch me over on Daddy on Board on Fridays. I'm also on The Trending Show from time to time. That publishes on the weekends. And then we'll be back here next week right around the same time with more of The Grizz for you.